You're listening to Curiosity Invited with David Bryan here on LA Talk Radio.
Hello, my name is David Bryan, and this is Curiosity Invited, a podcast inspired by endless curiosity. Tune in for an open-minded conversation about interesting and important things. Welcome to Curiosity Invited. My name is David Bryan. And in just a moment, you'll be either listening to or viewing and listening to my recent conversation with a good friend, Michael Abels, a music composer, and a musical composer as well. I think he is perhaps most, well, who knows anymore? I mean, his range of success in a variety of genres is enormous. So he did kind of explode onto the scene with Jordan Peele's Academy Award-winning film Get Out, and then for which Michael composed the score, and also did the score for Jordan Peele's next film Us, and then Nope. He's been nominated for 2 Emmys. He's got a stack of awards. I'll put a link to his awards page and you can see for yourself. Most recently, he's won Score of the Year 2023 for ASCAP in the ASCAP Awards. And also the same year, 2023, he and Rhiannon Giddens, the composers, creators of the opera Omar. They won Pulitzer Prize for their production of Omar. Michael is busy with work and awards, turns out. So when I asked him, it was a long shot for me, when I asked him if he would have time to do yet another podcast for me, with me, he did one perhaps 6 months ago, perhaps a year. I would urge you to listen to that one as well. I was so gratified that he said yes. And time was short. We squeezed it into an hour and a little bit. And I was, as always, delighted to have a conversation with my amazing friend, whose ability both to sort of understand, hear music, understand music, and explain to those of us who are not nearly in that world, but to explain to us how and why and what works for a piece of music. It's just uncanny and always fascinates me. I always have a wonderful time. Probably we both get a little silly, and I hope you like it. And Michael Abels, welcome back to Curiosity Invited. Thank you so much for being generous with your time. You know, the first time around, you were already busy and I was enormously grateful. The idea that you would be willing to do it again, like, so thank you so much. Thank you, really. I appreciate it.
You're very welcome, David. I adore you, and we've always had I find my today, leading up to this, I was thinking back about our history of our, and I have had nothing but wonderful conversations with you always. But they've always ended up around some other construct that causes us to speak. And so I've had these great conversations that have ranged about anything. Yes. And there was some other reason that we met that allowed us to have that conversation. So yes,
exactly. And then I went to your page, the IMDb, you know, Michael Abels Awards page, and it just went on and on. And I thought to myself, well, wait. Like, does he have to go to all of these things? How does he have time to do anything else?
It's very,
It's unbelievable. So do you appear at, or like, is there an expectation that you will show up at the various?
Well, it's very interesting, David. The awards economy, and there is an awards economy.
What does that mean?
There have been articles on this already, but there's actually an awards economy. An economy that exists in the entertainment industry to nominate and award people things.
Like, so we know that movies, you know, the producers of movies and studios, they spend a lot of money hoping to get their things seen and applauded and put on, et cetera, et cetera. But does that trickle down to, well, we know the major actors, but does that trickle down to everybody?
It trickles down to everybody. It's a huge economy, think of all the caterers who do nothing but cater, you know, award shows. Think of I'll never forget my first award show when it ended. And I'd never done this before, you know, and I went downstairs. There was a fleet of, I don't know how many, but let's easily 100 black, you know, SUV Suburbans in the belly of this giant, you know, hotel, all there to pick up people who had been at the party. They were all there simultaneously. And each one, the only way you could tell them apart was by each one had a number on their windshield. And you had to hope that you had remembered the number of your car, because if you had not, you were sunk.
Suddenly you'd end up in a mansion in Bel Air.
Because every single person in that award banquet came out at the same time to get into their black car.
Into their appropriately numbered black car.
Yes. And because those cars were all paid for by the producers or studios of, you know.
Yes.
And I say all this only just as I was observing what was happening and figuring out, you know, what all that must have meant. Like, there's this economy of, there's an awards economy, and it's fascinating.
And does that aspect of it make you jaded? It makes you exhausted. I get that. Something about it that feels
well, it's interesting. I mean, I'm trying to look at this as much as I'm now a part of it, you know. Also observing it as I would at the outside. And it's there are parts of it in which the composing is the original social distancing profession. And so the awards economy is the exact opposite. It only exists as a social construct, really. I mean, they did it during the pandemic, but, you know, all those people, the things I just meant, you know, the caterers and the people and the drivers and all of that.
They all stayed home.
Suddenly, they were all left out. You know, it wasn't really the economy economy is a social thing. And so it is by definition a distraction from what I do. And for writers, you know, also, and people who work in a way that we might call introversion, it's the exact opposite of what they do. And yet, the more you do the thing that you love or feel is your calling, and you do that, the more opportunity you have to do this thing that's the opposite, to go and engage people. And, you know, the way you get opportunities to engage your art is by interfacing with people and engaging with people and reaching audiences and you know.
Well, you use the word opportunity there, but it's certainly an opportunity, but is it an opportunity or is there an expectation that you will take this opportunity?
Well, it's no different than any other social. People are social animals. And anytime you receive an invitation from someone,
yes,
you know, sometimes you're unavailable, and that's just too bad. But that, by the same thing token, there's only so many times that those people will invite you.
Right.
If you're always unavailable, they must conclude that you're just unavailable, period.
Right. Right.
And that's no different if it's an award or if it's a, you know, I mean, the stakes are different and the people know you less.
Yeah. But
you won't be invited to your very best friend's house if you never accept. Okay.
And so, congratulations publicly on your winning of the yours and Rhiannon's the Pulitzer for music this year, which is
thank you.
Okay, here's so last time we were speaking, you had already created the opera, but because the opening was a little bit off in the distance, you had these opportunities to go back to it and change this and et cetera, et cetera. And then it was birthed. Did you have any expectation, not for the Pulitzer, but did you have any expectation that it would be so broadly and enthusiastically welcomed into that world?
I mean, we had some feeling that there was a lot of support for us because so many companies came on as co-commissioners in the period. There's a, you know, because opera has this long lead time, there were workshops in which we would demonstrate with just a couple singers and a couple instruments different parts of the work.
Mm-hmm.
And then they would and at these workshops they invite interested potential stakeholders, you know, people who might want to come on board at an early stage.
Yeah.
Help the work be seen, and that's very normal. And so the Spoleto USA Festival was able to get 4 or 5 different co-commissioners to come on board. And I mean, I don't have a lot of experience in knowing how that works, but that seemed like a high number to me.
Like, I was going to say,
wow,
that seems
good. Yeah. So we certainly felt like on the presenter side, that there was a lot of support.
Yeah.
For a lot of people who believed in the work, but you can't possibly, you know, I would always, one thing I do is you write a larger piece and then you, at least what I do is I wait. And then one morning I just get up and then I just play it on my computer in the computerized version. And I just sit there and I try to act like I'm an audience member, you know, I try to experience it and not have it be a part of me or my experience, and just ask myself, you know, am I entertained?
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, am I moved? Does this piece work? And I had always had a sense about, especially as we refined it, like we got to where I felt like every part of it, I could say, this works. This does exactly what it needs to do. But there's nothing like feeling that and then feeling that in an audience full of people. It's just...
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But because you've spent so many years hoping that that might be the possibility, when it proves true, it's beyond words to explain what that's like.
Well, it's from this side watching it happen out there, it's just so splendid, and I'm so happy. And then, in certain ways, it seemed like the Pulitzer was icing on the cake, and well, of course. Of course it would. What are you talking about?
Well,
so you've been, since last time we spoke, you've been stocking up on awards. and it was that question that, you know, that is there, how does one fit all that into a life and still allow the muse to come visit?
Well, you have to work, you have to struggle to balance those things. And it's challenging.
I'll bet. It's challenging.
And there are, you know, there are periods of time, sometimes weeks of time, which are given up to, you know, the extrovert side of what that is.
Mm-hmm.
And responding to the world that whose attention you have struggled to get. And then you've got it and you discover that.
I didn't mean that's not what I meant.
No.
Do that over there.
Exactly. Yeah. So anyway, you have that as your next level of how do I manage this, you know? But it's a it's a blessing to have a problem like that. So,
yes.
but you find that, you know, internally the spiritual nurturement comes from having that connection with the creative, with the creative divine energy, you know, and that it's kind of a spiritual practice in that way. So
I also was wondering about, excuse me. you know, I don't remember who it was years ago reading. I think it was a rock musician, or he was talking about, you know, you work for years creating, you know, you're writing your songs and you're putting it out there and you're try it with this band, this version of the band, that version of the band, whatever. And then, you know, you're suddenly after 15 years, 10 years, an overnight success, right?
Yes.
All of a sudden you're
overnight.
Overnight. And your album is a huge hit. And now everybody wants the next one. And that, you know, it took 10 or 15 years to put that one together. And people want the next one. When is the next one happening? And I'm wondering if there is a parallel in your work where now that you've exploded onto the scene, and it really has. It has been, you know, it's been a rocket taking off. And is there now this, like, okay, well, what's next? What's next? Is there a parallel to that?
The great part about it is that it doesn't, I understand that it's a rocket, but it doesn't feel like a rocket. like, you know, it feels like years of steady progression.
Yes.
Which is much calmer than a rocket, even though it looks like a rocket externally, you know.
Well,
and if I had gone from where it was 5-7 years ago to today, that would be a rocket. But there have been those years in there, in those years, oh my gosh, that's been the scaffolding that has, you know, on which I'm relying at this moment. So that part's important.
And have you? I don't know how else to ask this question. Have you reached the point in your career, in this aspect of what you do, to say no to?
Oh yeah.
Yes.
I have to.
Look, I was wondering about that.
Occasionally it's a project that's not right for me.
Right. But when the project is right, you know, there's just like people could be throwing gold at you, and you want, because it's gold, ambrosia, it's the best. It's, you know, it's manna from heaven. It's the thing, and it's rich and fabulous. And, you know, last time we spoke, you were had just finished sort of the opera, and you had written something for Hilary Hahn, and I don't know if that ever did that ever get recorded and
she was nominated for a Grammy for her recording of it.
Of that.
Yes.
Yeah, see, there's another. Well, so you know, are those being peppered at you so quickly that at some point you have to say no to those, or have you been lucky enough to just turn down projects that are not right for you?
Sometimes I have to turn down something that is right for me that I would love to do, but I just don't have the time to do. And that's bad.
That's the good, I guess that's the good problem to have, right?
Yeah. It's a good problem to have.
Yeah.
But you know, you want, of course, to, I get offered, mostly what I get offered is really interesting stuff that, is usually has some, you know, aspect of social justice, but maybe not in an obvious way, you know, which is, even though there'll be things that are like nothing like Get Out, they would share that in common with the movie Get Out, that there would be something that it works as entertainment, but then also there's another dynamic that allows conversation and,
right.
No, which is things that I love. Like, that's something you and I share. So
yes,
And then a lot of it involves social justice in some way, and that's really interesting. And then all and any of these people who I would talk to are really just incredible artists in their own right, who have all sorts of things going on, and you know, lists of awards that I'm intimidated by, and it's pretty cool. So
very few of them have. I'm just guessing. Very few have an awards page that is as long. I just looked. I just looked. I didn't
count.
But I looked at Danny Elfman's page. I looked at John Williams' page. Now that is
their pages wonderful. They're not pages. They're entire novels.
Yes, but
entire novels. Those the two of them. My mind is in no way long, as long as
no. There. No, that's true. That is true. But that's where we are.
Oh my
God. Those are the comparisons. So
well, thank you.
So, yeah.
And what else? And I am getting in this next time. If we talk again, I will probably be in a new studio space that I'm doing. And that's very exciting.
A new studio space at your home or a new studio space elsewhere?
Elsewhere, yeah. Because it's been time to have a it's interesting. It's like gameplay in that you play at a level until you've completed that level, and then you level up and you suddenly are like, oh, well, I have some of the skills that I need, but oh, what's this? Oh, I'm dead. But I just leveled up. What do you mean I'm dead? So it's really kind of like that. And the problem is you know, you can often talk to someone who's on, not often, but like you look at someone who's on level 34 and you think, oh, that must be great. And you're on level 10. And what you need is coaching on level 11, not level 34.
Yes. Right.
And that's it's really hard to assess the number of your level and who's on the level, like maybe one or two above you, and then be able to get coaching from them on, oh yeah, I was just at level 10 and I remember this, you know, don't go in that door, wait. But so anyway, there's not coaching like that. So you have to like die a few times on your level. And so I'm currently like about to move into my new studio, which is amazing. And I can't wait, but I'm also sure that it'll cost me a couple lives before I get that.
So making it less abstract, What are the things that will be available and or present or the capacity at a new studio that are not there?
Oh well, there's a capacity to and so I work at home and I work in this which is rather dark right now, but actually a beautiful peaceful room with my piano and it's a little small for bringing a director or showrunner, which I've done, you know, many times, but personally I still feel like it's a little smaller than I would like.
Mm-hmm.
The people who assist me, we mostly work remotely, which we set up prior to the pandemic, and then when the pandemic happened we were suddenly like, great, this is what we always do. We were relatively unaffected compared to a lot of people because we were working remotely, but there are things that you get from working in the same building environment.
Right.
And so the new space sets up, you know, one or more of us working in the same place and having that be an option and having clients over and having them feel like they're in a
space
that is like, here's a workspace, here's the hangout space. You know, it's a.
And is there technological aspects to this studio that you now will soon?
Yes, because when you start from scratch, you can go, okay, now that I'm starting, I want to do it this way. You know, so there's upgrades and things like that. And I think I'm getting I've had this piano since I was 20, and I'm getting a new
piano. 3 years.
Yes, so it's been a really great 3 years, but I think I'll be saying goodbye and getting a new piano.
Oh, wow.
In fact, I've picked it out. I'm just waiting for place to be ready to get delivery of a nice piano in.
Ah, fabulous. That's great.
So these are all really great milestones. That
I have some fun questions for you that people have said, oh, you're going to speak to Michael Abels again? Yes. And then it's like, well, what's his go-to music?
Oh.
Does he even like horror movies? What is your go-to? Do you have a go-to style? Like if you put something on to...
I live in a music factory, you know, so by choice, which I've worked hard to create. So when I go home from work, that's not necessarily what I want to do.
Yes. you live in a Zen monastery at home.
when I explain it that way, people are like, oh, okay, that makes sense. You know?
Yeah.
And when I'm just really wanting to chill out, I quite honestly listen to chill out music.
Yes.
You know? And it's because it creates an emotion in me, not because I follow a particular artist, you know?
Right. And do you like horror films?
I'm completely not a fan in the way that Jordan Peele is. You know, he's a student of every single one of them. And he knows all the ones that work, he knows why they work. And he can give you a scene by scene analysis of everything about that makes them work. And it's stunning. His comedic knowledge, but also just his devoted, his devotion to knowing, like, the thing that he and I have in common is like the thing he has about film, and particularly, you know, horror and suspense. I feel that way about genres of music. The minute I hear something that intrigues me, I have to mentally, I'm taking it apart and going like, how does this work? And why is this, what is interesting about this? What makes me feel this way? I'm just dissecting it like the way mechanical people, you know, will take things apart and put them back together again, just to understand how it works. And that's how I listen to music. And so when you listen to music that way, it can be distracting.
Mm-hmm.
And so sometimes I'm deliberately not listening to music.
Yeah.
To rest.
One of the things, it's been my naive experience of you over the years. But I've now heard it repeated so often in various articles, et cetera, et cetera. You have a range of, we certainly have a range of understanding about music and music genre and arts genre generally, but certainly music, that always to me felt enormous, but I don't count as a measuring stick, you know. My ruler goes up to a foot at the most. Yeah. But people who are steeped in music speak about the how adept you are at understanding and producing and, you know, composing for a variety of musical genres. And I'm wondering if that's opened up doors, like, do things come in your door that, or, you know, wherever they come, your email, your inbox or your telephone, that where you are offered something or at least asked about whether you have an interest in something in an area that you feel like, I'm really interested in that, but I don't know very much about that, or I don't have that that
musical muscle,
that facility with the other ranges. So first of all, is it true? is it true that your range of those kinds of things? And don't be modest here. I mean, don't be more modest than you need to be. But is it the case that your breadth of musical, I don't know if it's expertise or familiarity, is larger than many people, many musicians, many, many composers, and are there genres that that feel like they're just over there, you know, not level 34 perhaps, but level 12, level 13. So they might require skipping a level or two, but that's really interesting. But is there that? Does that happen?
I hear several questions there. Like,
you know, you're a smart guy. You're going to figure them all
out. I like, one of the things that fascinates me about music is that all the differences that we perceive in genres of music. That's been a thing that I've been excited about since I was a child, really.
Yes.
So if I'm more versed in a variety of genres than others, it's because that's one of the primary things that interests me. You know, I want to be facile in different genres because I enjoy it so much. The way people approach you about on projects is usually based on they've heard something done, and they can therefore imagine you doing something. And it's what they can imagine based on what you've done is never the complete opposite. It's always something that's similar, you know? Yeah. So even if people who think of me as being, you know, pretty genre diverse, you know, it's because they've heard something and that thing makes them think of me for this other thing. So there's some relationship you can usually, even if they weren't to say what it was, you could say, oh, because of this, you know. But I think it, everybody also wants their project, no matter the medium, to have a specific sonic identity and visual identity and story. You know, they want something that is unique in some way. And so having some versatility in genre allows me to have more colors in my palette, have more that I can pitch to them and say, well, what if we did it this way, and not feel like, oh, I can't, you know, I'm going to be going out of my, I'm going to be out of my lane. I don't feel that often. I think, oh, well, we could try it this way and see. And so I think that's where I have the most opportunity to, the most opportunity to stretch is by saying, offering up that we could do something that people may not expect.
And do you find yourself yearning for, is there an out there that you would like to be at that nobody's come knocking for?
Well, let's see. So I haven't done, so when the Pas de Deux from Us, which is the piece that spins, I got 5 on it. When people really responded to that, I thought, you know, I want to do more kind of horror takes on music. People have no idea how many of those there could be. And I just can't. It's one of those things where I'm sure if I build it, they will come, you know. It's like, oh, I'm clear what a great idea this is, and this needs to happen. But I haven't found anyone else who says, oh my goodness, yes, we're going to
put that in. Yes.
People just smile and nod and say, yes, that'll be great. But then they just wait for me to do it, you know, because it doesn't put them to do nothing about this. So, but meanwhile, I've been doing other things. And so that hasn't happened yet, but we'll see. I still think there would be to be a, be a producer in that sense, you know, like a music producer.
Yes.
Somehow the difference between composer and producer are very unclear to me, but to people who identify as producers, a lot of times they do not identify as composers at all, but I feel like they're close. And but I've never done a project where I'm really just like, I'm a producer in the, you know, hit record sort of sense lately anyway.
So, you know, inform me. So what would a producer in that sense do that you're not doing?
This could be a long conversation. I think part of it is a label based on musical culture. Is that the word producer is more associated in, you know, in songs, and the person who produces a song could be the composer of the song.
Could right. be. But, or, it's often not.
But it's often not. Yeah. Right. And if the, and let's say, just for distinction's sake, let's say that it's, if you're producing a song that you haven't written yourself, you may be providing, you may be providing an arrangement of the song. You may be changing everything about the instruments of the song. You might be changing the chords. You might be changing the beat. Almost everything recognizable about the song, except perhaps the melody and the lyrics.
Mm-hmm.
You then might be coaching the singer in their delivery of the song.
Mm-hmm.
And that's especially important in producing a song, is singing is, you know, so some of it is musicianship, but so much of it is acting and many other things, and delivering a song, having a producer in the booth to give the singer feedback as they're doing what they're doing it really helps.
Sure.
Yeah, it really helps recreate the experience of hearing someone live, as opposed to them in a dark studio all by themselves. And then you could, with an inexperienced singer, get a very unengaging performance, which just has to do with the singer's, you know, environment of the moment, not about what's. And so having people to actually perform for makes a huge difference for a lot of musicians, but especially singers. And so a producer also, there's a lot of technical expertise that goes into producing music, a song that involves kind of sonic enhancement, sonic ear candy that is provided by the wonderful technologies that we have, and learning how to mix a song in a way that makes it actually shake the speakers of your car when that's important, or making it feel like you're in a wash of beautiful sonic pillows when that's important. Mm-hmm. And all the sonic placement of things is often done by a producer. So it's really a enhanced 3D composing experience.
I totally can see you doing that.
Oh, wow.
I can, from this naive point of view, right? But I mean, having, I know we spoke about this last time, but, you know, having watched you assemble that particular show, that first show in the theater, was, you know, you saw something and heard something long before it actually happened on stage. So.
And I look back and I'm still amazed that that happened.
It
mostly happened the way that we planned it. Mostly.
Well, that's actually one of the things I was wondering about Omar. The opera that you and Rhiannon created. So you collaborated, you worked together, you know, this remarkable piece, and then you pour people into it. And there are singers and there's sets and were you surprised by things that with the net result of that? Because I mean, you and she created the music and the, libretto?
Libretto is the
fancy story, right?
The lyrics, yeah.
Right, the lyrics, the story, the music, and now it's being staged and all of those other things that come with when a production gets put on. And was it what you expected? Did you see... Is that what you saw? Is that what you saw when you were dreaming all this?
In a very dull way, I can say yes, only because there are moments in a staged drama that you need to be there when there's a moment of action, when the plot is moving, you need to understand, you need, at least for me, to write that music, I need to be able to see it And of course, that's not possible. So I imagine it.
Yes.
I imagine it, and I imagine it not just in a, as a stationary picture, but I imagine it in time. I sit and I meditate, and I imagine that whole thing playing out as if I'm an audience member of this stage thing in my mind. And then I hit a timer when I'm done. And then I do it again, and I hit it, and I hit the time, and I do it again until the way I envision it takes a certain amount of time, until that it aligns. Every time I imagine this unfolding in all of its grandness or all of its lack or in all of its feeling, it takes a certain amount of time. And then I know that's how much music to write.
Oh my gosh.
Because I know that I've created the scene, and I know how long, and music doesn't take place in a frame. It takes place in time. Time is the frame of musical art. So I need a frame. And so I create the frame by visualizing it and timing. And when I have the frame, then I write the music.
You literally sit there with a timer? I mean, there's actually a timer.
And I imagine, okay, this is the scene. And in Omar, it was particularly important. Well, there's like the first act's very narrative. And there's scenes where it's filled with things where stuff happens. And because we're in the 21st century, we've all seen movies, we need it to happen in a cinematic way. We need it to happen not in the glacial pace of the 1700s or 1800s. So I imagine the movie scene, you know, but I imagine it on the stage. I don't imagine it, you know, because we don't. For example, in Omar, there's a horrible moment where the Senegalese village is overrun with slavers. And that's horrible and terrible. And then in the next scene, we're in the belly of the slave ship. And I had to write that transition. And I felt like it was the most crucial transition in the opera. Because, you know, it's foreshadowed, but then it happens. And you definitely don't know that you're going to the belly of a slave ship in 45 seconds. But I had to visualize, what's that going to be like? So it's not just a cut like in the film. There's set pieces that are going to have to roll in and out, and things are going to have to go up and down, and, you know, and a character dies and we want to mourn that. And so I would sit there and I would visualize how that might happen on stage till I figured out about how long felt right for such a significant event to happen. And then that's how much music I wrote. And I wrote it last. So the scene before and the scene after were already done. And Rhiannon and I, we had gotten those scenes, so they were both great and working from those points. But then there was this hairy transition. And so I visualized how the stage might look and timed it, and then I wrote the music. But then, so that's the way in which the answer to your question is yes, it happens. Yes. Because the music, it's timing, right? And so you're writing, there's a way when you're writing opera that you're the director, because everything goes to the music. So if as a composer, we say it's a 45 second transition, then it will be, you know, because that's how long the music is. Now, but then there's the way in which it's not how we envisioned it. And the answer is it's much greater than we ever could have envisioned it, because you get an experienced stage director, and they take whatever you've done, and then they add their vision, and they're the ones who are actually talented in envisioning it. And the result is just, you know, I get choked up thinking about just how freaking magnificent our looks staged, because Kaneza Shaal is a genius, and her production designer, Christopher Myers, is another genius. And together, they just created the world of, as you know, Omar's story is really, it's, you know, it's bleak. He's enslaved.
Yes.
The way they tell it, the purpose of the story is it's about the power of faith to transcend even the most egregious suffering. And they understood that, and they brought out, just as in the music, the beauty of that possibility is revealed through the music. They reveal it through their set design and through their production design. And that the collaboration there between the music and in that, you can tell I'm overcome whenever I talk about it.
Wow.
And then there are things you can do in opera where you are allowed to just, you know, you could tell how important it was for me to get the pacing right of narrative parts. But then the opposite is there are moments where you can just stop and you can meditate on a moment and feel its, you know, beauty or significance. And then in those moments, it's okay that a character has died, but now she's a ghost and she's back. And, you know, we in opera, we accept that because it's about, there's an element of it that's performance art. And then at the end of Omar, whereas the first act takes place in very specific places, the end of Omar takes place kind of in a non-specific location.
No place, yes, right.
Because it's a meditation on faith and the human condition, and it doesn't need to be in a particular setting. And so the way that, when we showed the libretto to, you know, people just reading it, they were just like, well, where's this scene? You know, like, what's the location? It struck some people as odd, you know, but it didn't even occur to me and Rhiannon that it was, it seemed like the natural ending. Like to us, it was like, oh, I guess it doesn't happen. We didn't even think about it. But then of course the stage director, she completely got that. And the way it's staged, it opens up into this beat that looks like you would see like pictures you see of like the African Serengeti, and there'll be a single tree with it, right? And it's that sort of tree. It's one enormous tree in a otherwise, you know, relatively empty stage, and the tree takes up the entire stage, and it is rope, and all we've seen during the whole opera is rope and fabric being used in other ways. And at the end, this enormous tree happens, and it's gorgeous.
That was vivid. Thank you. Well, Michael, I'm looking at my clock, and I know your clock has this bounded by 4. So I want to make sure to get you off in 4 minutes. But so I have an odd question that almost feels, well, it'll snap us out of that trance we were, you've managed to put us in with even the description of Omar. So all this talk brouhaha about AI and it's both its power, and depending upon who you talk to, I spoke to on the podcast a computer scientist who made me feel better about it all, but then, you know, recently human extinction conversation, etc.
That's a little human extinction.
Where's the human extinction when you need it? Can you imagine? Have you? Are there things about AI and the art world, the music world, that periodically cause you to wake up in the middle of the night?
Well, currently we're in the middle of the WGA writer's strike, at which at the point of us recording has been going on for a month.
Yeah, I think that's right.
And they are speaking for all of us creatives, in that they want protections against how AI is used. And because it's this technology, we don't know what the end result of it is. And it's terrifying in not knowing. Composers have the same issues about AI that writers do. Absolutely. And that's one side of it. The other side of it is that the history of music is that whenever there has been a technological advance, it has made people very afraid. And people have responded by saying, shut it down.
Mm-hmm.
I'm thinking back to the invention of the phonograph record. People thought, do you mean people are just going to listen to music that's recorded on, you know, this thing? Well, they'll never listen to live music again. We can't let that happen. We have to shut it down. Well, and what happened was that provided a whole new experience, which made people love music more. And, you know, and then, you know, jump ahead a few steps, multi-track recording, where you could record and then record another thing, and then they'd play back together, and people would go, are you kidding? No one's going to hire musicians ever again. They're just going to hire one person to play 89 different things and will never work. And, you know, you can't allow that. Well, and the way we recorded changed, and some things changed, but then it also opened some creative possibility. And it's true, not everybody got called to be hired who used to be called, but then other people got called to do different things. Mm-hmm. So the technology evolves. So if you're an optimist, you want to say, okay, AI is going to evolve everything we do. And it's going to cause some people to not be hired where they might have been. But it's going to open up other possibilities that we don't quite know yet for humans to participate and interact. And so the way we work will continue to evolve. And that will be not good news for some jobs and some economies, and new economies and jobs will be created. And yet, AI seems especially more scary than the phonograph record or multi-track recording or sampling or any of these other technologies.
Yes.
And I think that we're wise to be worried. Now, as it happened, I was asked to write a piece in collaborating with an AI about 2 years ago. And an AI company asked me and several other composers to collaborate with their AI and to write a piece. And I wrote this piece, and it's called Gift of the Machine. And there's a recording of it. And how I wrote it was that one of the options, so this particular AI, you could tell it, well, I want music in this style, in this genre, and I want it to be this long, you know, 90 seconds, like 3 minutes, whatever. And I want it to have these instruments. And then you hit, you know, make or send.
And the circle goes around for a few minutes. And,
right, and the circle goes around for about 15 seconds. And then you have this piece that's exactly to your. And so the ability to generate content is just instantaneous. And then you listen to that content. And at least at the time that I did that, there were many things lacking from what it would have been if it had been produced by a professional composer. And as a professional composer, that was a relief to see. I felt like I was still ahead of it, although I wasn't in terms of speed of content generation.
Sure. Right. But
of the content it generated, there would occasionally be something that to my ear was an interesting idea. Mm-hmm. But the machine did not know that that was an interesting idea, as opposed to the thing it had just done.
Right.
So therefore, the interesting idea was not exploited,
right,
developed in a way that a human, when they have an interesting idea, knows this is an interesting idea, and I'm going to make this into something. Mm-hmm. So it was like a pebble skipping across a lake, and like the interesting place was given no more attention than the place that was not interesting. Just on to the next.
Yeah.
So what I did was I curated the machine's ideas. I curated the content, and I went, oh, I like this and I like that. And these things go together in the way that everything else does not. And I like this idea, and I know how this idea could relate to that idea in a way that this music does not demonstrate any understanding of. Mm-hmm. And so I did that. And so I curated the machine's ideas into a piece. And I provided the AI company with an analysis of what it was doing well. Oh, and I fed music that I wrote into the machine, which I thought, I'm really canceling myself here by doing this. But I wanted to see what it thought of that. You know, and when I said, you know, create content like this. And I wanted to see what it thought of that. And it was interesting, the things that it thought were significant about that music. And it would write piano music, and its piano music would in some cases take five hands to perform. because the machine does not have opposable thumbs or understand how people learn to play the piano. So its piano music had a piano sound, but it was not pianistic. Mm-hmm. And so these were things that I had to solve. And I showed the AI company how I did that and how the piece was generated. And they were excited that I could explain it in a way that was so clear, you know.
Yes.
The piece I wrote was not a piece I ever would have written if I had not been inspired by the AI's content. And yeah. So therefore it was a true collaboration with this with this code. And that was a couple of years ago. So I have no idea how smart their AI has become, but I trust it is much better than it was.
Well, as far as I know, it is, well, not specifically the music piece, but it is much smarter. But what you've described has very close parallels with what the computer, the software engineer, the researcher, you know, in that world and spoke about. I mean, what the computers do now, they could get better at this, and they could go beyond this, which is, I think, what scares people. But essentially, they have one task, and that is to predict the next word, right? And the data they have are all the things that are, you know, on the internet. That's the miracle of the internet, right? I mean, it's all the stuff that human beings have produced. And so they have all this stuff. This is an example of what human beings could produce. So, and the mistakes they make is to, they don't have that discerning quality that you just pointed at. They can predict next. They can predict next, and they can do it really efficiently. But
curation is not prediction.
No, exactly.
Curation is not prediction. Curation is sometimes the unpredictable.
Yes.
But and yet, on the unpredictable in a way that continues a theme. And
the way you parsed it, if you're an optimist.
You're right.
And if you're not, you're getting up at 2 o'clock in the morning. And if you are, you're sleeping through the night before you level up. That may be a way to quickly level up to level 34, whatever the hell is going on there. But well, Michael, I'm honoring Mary Grace may be mad at me for taking
it's,
you.
It's my own fault. It's my own fault. I saw the time and I went over, so it's okay.
Well, Michael, always just so good to speak with you. And thank you. And and who knows, maybe we'll do this again.
Maybe. I hope so.
By then your page will be, I won't have a computer screen large enough.
Ah.
Hey, lovely to see you, it really is. And congratulations again on the Pulitzer and everything else you've won, the ASCAP thing and oh, God. Anyway, I hope you're well. I hope you're staying healthy. Are you doing things to remain healthy?
I'm trying.
Okay.
You look very well. And so I will be following your regimen, whatever it is.
Yeah, whatever it is. Okay.
You're listening to Curiosity Invited with David Bryan here on LA Talk Radio.